Bring in Jim Callis, senior writer at MLB Pipeline and MLB.com. Hello, Mr. Callis. You're on with Mr. Blair and Mr. Carey.
Hey, guys. Two of my favorite baseball writers. How are you guys doing?
Oh, you're nice.
Really, oh, we love being, we love praise.
We do. We do. And I'm so, top 100, look, I mean, this is catnip. It's Travis puts out the schedule. I'm like, we're going to get Callis for 20 minutes to talk. Oh, yes. Yes, yes, yes. And literally, I might ask you 20 minutes worth of questions about... No, I'm going to ask you 20 hours worth of questions about Vladdy Jr. Then we're going to have you back another day and talk about Anthony Alford. We'll do the Alford stuff in a second because we were talking off air about how strongly I feel about him. But Vladdy Jr., you know, Vladdy Sr., of course, a big part of my adolescence and early adulthood and whatever. And such a phenomenal player. And Vladdy Jr. is just polished in a way that his dad was not. The lack of polish was part of the appeal of dad, of course. But you look at Guerrero Jr. and you almost don't know what his upside is because aside from all his raw skill, the dude walked more times than he struck out last year and he was a teenager. You're not supposed to have Tony Gwynn level hand-eye coordination and batting eye and have this kind of raw power. Number three, I know that I understand Acuna's great and I understand Ohtani and stuff like that. This guy could be a 10-time All-Star. He's just phenomenally amazing. I'm chomping at the bit to see this guy in the big leagues at this point.
No, I am too. You know, and you talk about him being a teenager. He wasn't just a teenager. He was 18. It wasn't like he was even 19. I mean, he was the age of like a high school senior, and instead he's tearing up two Class A levels, and he's almost leading the minors on base percentage. And you're right. I mean, he's very reminiscent of his dad, but with more selectivity. The comparison I get the most on him is Miguel Cabrera, which I think worked on a number of levels, also down to the, you know, he's never going to be a great third baseman. He might be a first baseman or a DH or a left fielder, but it's not going to matter. And I'm with you. I mean, when we do these lists, there's a number of us who vote on them, and I wasn't like angry or anything, but I voted Vlad Jr. number one.
Yeah.
I just, the difference to me between him and Acuna and Ohtani is there's no doubt in my mind that Vlad Guerrero Jr. is going to hit zero. I mean, he's going to hit big. I mean, we're not scouts, but we put grades on players. We gave him the first 80 hit we've ever given anybody on the 20-80 scouting scale, and the power is a 65. I mean, I think he's a guy. I know we got the hyperbole machine rolling here, and on the last two MLB Network shows, I've said, part joking, but part seriously, that he and his dad will be the first father-son Hall of Fame combo ever. But, I mean, we're looking at a guy who you look at him, I mean, how's this guy not going to hit 320 with 30, 35, 40 homers a year? I mean, it's insane. I don't ever remember seeing a young hitter like this ever. I mean, I don't really know what you would do to improve upon him at the plate, because he's got all the physical tools, he's got all the mental tools, he's, you know, I mean, I don't know. There's not much more he could do. I mean, yeah, you wish he was better defensively, but it's like Miguel Cabrera. Who cares? You know, if he's hitting 320 with 35 or 40 homers, he can play any position, you know, you have a spot in your lineup.
I'm wondering about, you know, Jonah talked about his walks, and I told Jonah the story off air. The first time I interviewed Vladdy Jr. at the Jays minor league complex, the first question I asked him was, how is he different than his dad? And his first response through a translator was, I'll take a walk. Those were the first four words I heard Vladdy Jr. say, I'll take a walk. Does that translate from the minors to the major leagues? Does selectivity necessarily translate? Is it one of those stats, Jim, that does carry over very well and generally can be reflective of a player's abilities?
Hey, I think it depends on the player's ability, because there's a couple things at play in the minor leagues. One is, you know, especially in A-ball, the pitchers aren't as good as you're going to see in the major leagues. So you'll have guys, and you see them, who draw a lot of walks in the minors, who are going up there looking for walks. But if those players, a lot of times, they don't even make it to the major leagues, if they get to the big leagues, they aren't going to be feared as hitters, and nobody, you know, nobody's going to fear throwing them strikes. So it's a matter of taking advantage of less qualified pitchers. And two, there's a difference between being selective and, you know, being able to do damage at the plate. And, you know, I remember Nick Swisher, when he was coming up, struggled in AAA, and he talked about this because Nick was a very patient hitter in the big leagues too, but it was in AAA where he kind of learned the difference that, like, you can't just go up there and say, okay, you know, we all know, I mean, when the Moneyball era, you know, the A's were promoting plate discipline, and you know, whoever the highest walk rate at each level will get an award every month, all that. It's not just a matter of selectivity. Isn't just, okay, I'm going to go up there and take until they throw me the first strike, which is funny. That reminds me, Joey Votto, I don't know if you guys remember, Votto at one point in his minor league career, the Reds had a new administration, and they decreed that their hitters were going to take, this was during the height of Moneyball, their hitters were going to take pitches in the minors until they got a strike.
Right.
Well, you know, that word gets around pretty quickly, and so a lot of those guys found themselves down 0-1. Kevin Youkilis struggled in AAA too. But getting back to Swisher, he kind of learned the difference between, you know, being, you know, going up and trying to draw a walk and being selective. Because to me, the key is getting yourself in a position where you're going to count, where you're going to get a pitch you can do damage to. And I think that's what Vlad has. He's not just, you know, going up there, okay, I'm not going to swing, I'm going to, you know, look for, to draw walks. He's the perfect hitter. I mean, I know this sounds crazy because he's 18 and we're talking about the guy like he is going to be Hall of Famer. But no, he is the perfect hitter from the standpoint of, if you don't challenge him, he's not going to chase. He's not going to be like his dad and hit the ball off one bounce and get a base hit. He'll take the walk if you don't challenge him. But the whole time, he's looking to do damage. You know, if you fall behind him 2-0, you know, he's sitting fastball or whatever, depending on the pitcher, and he's looking to drive it. So it's, there's, I guess that's a long way, Jeff, of saying there's like good selectivity and less good selectivity among minor league hitters. But I think he's got the good selectivity because it's not just, hey, I'm looking to draw walks. It's more, hey, if you aren't going to challenge me, I'll take the walk. But if you challenge me, I'm going to crush you.
Jeff and I are now looking at pictures of Vladdy Jr. when he was a three-year-old standing on the field at Olympic Stadium. The cutest child of all time, and now he's going to be a Hall of Famer. Well, we don't know. But we're excited about it, the hype. Speaking of hype, I'm going to come out with my first hot take of my week, guest hosting on the Jeff Blair Show, and here it is. The best outfielder currently in the Jays organization, as in major league-ready outfielder, as in the guy who's the best, to me is Anthony Alford. He doesn't have the splits that Curtis Granderson has. He doesn't have the offensive deficiencies that Kevin Pillar has. He doesn't have the holes in his swing that Randall Grichuk has. Anthony Alford hit .299 with a .390 OB last year and ended the year playing in Double A. Now, granted, he is young. He could use more polish. We'll see. But that kind of batting eye and that kind of athleticism, I submit to you that Anthony Alford could be an effective leadoff man who could play 140 games and be a quality big leaguer right now in the big leagues. What say you, Jim Callis?
I will buy that. It's funny, when you first started that, I thought you were saying he was their best outfield prospect. I'm like, well, what's the hot take about that? Who's the other outfield prospect?
Yes.
Outfielder. I agree with you, and I think the thing to remember about him too is he's a young 23, if you will, because he basically took 2 years off to play college football. And what amazed me about him when he came back from that, he bounced around a couple college football programs, is that usually when you lose 1,000 at-bats like that, if it doesn't do irreparable harm to your baseball career, you know, it pitchers, I think, can do the two-sport thing because it's, you know, kind of arm strength and quality arm. And, you know, you can, you know, Jeff Samardzija, you can learn on the fly. But if you have your Drew Hensons of the world who give up too many at-bats, you don't get those back. And he pretty much stepped right in and showed command of the strike zone a couple of years ago when he came back to baseball. And I'm with you. I think he is very well-rounded. I think he could be a leadoff guy. I don't think he's going to be a big power guy, but I do think there's a little sneaky pop in there where he might be a 10, 12, 15 home run guy. I think he plays a good center field. I mean, he wouldn't probably depose Pillar, but he could play in a corner. I really like Anthony Alford, and I think because of the injuries in 2016 and 2017, he's kind of, you know, fallen. I mean, he's on our top 100. He's on everybody's top 100. But I don't think he gets the acclaim from fans necessarily just because he's been hurt and been sidetracked. But what he's been able to accomplish with the limited amount of professional at-bats he's had since he signed in 2012 is pretty amazing.
Well, and Jonah and I talked about this off the air, but I mean, the Blue Jays coaching staff will tell you to a man, they would love him to push the envelope in spring training. Like, they would love him to force them to make a decision because he has a lot of fans in the major league staff. And, you know, even though they only got to see him a short time before that injury last year. The other thing I like about Anthony Alford, this is the guy that went down and played winter ball in Mexico this year and played, 29, 30 games, stayed down there. We had him on the air, and he was talking about, you know, I've never seen as many breaking pitches and fastball counts. And you know, he said, look, I thought it was a great experience. He said, I don't know, it's something I may want to do again. I certainly came away from it feeling that I'd learned something. And I think you're right. I think we kind of underestimate just how many at bats this guy is behind a lot of players of his equivalent age. And I really do think there's something there. I think when a guy is willing to do that, go down to winter ball, shows me you're not afraid to step out of your comfort zone. And those are the type of guys that are entirely capable of surprising you in spring training.
No, you're right. I mean, if you look at the fact, I mean, he's played parts of six professional seasons, and part of that, you know, he was playing football, and he's been hurt. I mean, he's basically had three full seasons worth of at-bats in 6 years as a pro, and I do think he wants it. And you know, and that's another thing with a lot of times these two-sport guys, like, I don't know, like Quincy Carter always jumps to mind to me is one of them, where, you know, they like playing both sports until they struggle. Or Chad Hutchinson was another guy. You know, they struggle and then they run to the other sport. And I think he really likes playing baseball, and I think it shows. And he's not just, you know, the cliched, you know, great athlete who's got tools and not skills. He's especially considering how inexperienced he is. He's a really, really refined player.
So Bo Bichette. He had 372 last year. That's pretty good, I think. This is advanced stats, but I'm pretty sure 372 is pretty strong. Another teenager, 19 years old, great bat on ball skills, and this was high A. You know, he ended the year at Dunedin, so that's advanced as far as age and level goes. And there's a lot of promise around this guy. You know, close to top 10 in many areas. You have a 14 MLB pipeline. I guess we could certainly get to the offense, but maybe let's backtrack a little bit. Is he going to play shortstop? He's not a little guy, right? He's about 6 foot, 200. He'll certainly gain weight as he gets older. And listen, you hit 372 or even anywhere close to that, you're going to play anywhere. But if we're talking about him maybe sticking at that position, now you're talking about a truly super elite player because guys do not hit at that level at that position.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about, this is a guy who won the first teenager to win the minor league batting title since 1966.
Wow.
I mean, he's a very gifted hitter. I remember seeing him at the Under Armour All-America game going into his senior year, and he won the home run derby, and he was impressive. But he had a lot going on in his swing, and the question was, is that going to translate? And the Jays have cleaned that up a little bit, but obviously it's translated. I mean, he hit a ton in the Gulf Coast League in his pro debut, too. I don't think he stays at shortstop. I think he's the best way to put it, he's got a chance to stay at shortstop. But when you're talking about shortstop, usually the guys, when you say, oh, they have a chance, you know, you want a better defender than that at shortstop. I mean, in a perfect world, you'd love for Guerrero Jr. to be an average third baseman, and you'd love for Bichette to be an average shortstop. And that's probably not going to be the case. I think Bichette winds up at second or third. I mean, from a body type, he's kind of comparable maybe to Brett Boone.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't really, you know, I mean, they're different players, obviously. But, like, you know, Brett Boone, you didn't really ever envision, you know, as a shortstop. You know, the difference, I think, between him and Boone is, again, I mean, he really controls the strike zone better than Brett does, and I think he's going to hit more for average, you know. And, you know, the power might not be too far off. I mean, I think Bo's got a chance to, you know, again, I mean, he's a guy who is capable of winning batting titles, and he might be 20 or more homers a season, maybe even a little bit more than that. I mean, he can really, really hit. And you're talking, again, when we're talking about these other guys, I mean, this guy loves the game. I mean, he wants to play baseball 24/7. He's going to do, you know, and not that he's been challenged too much, but whatever he needs to do to get better, it's not a case where you wonder, oh, is he going to put the time in? I haven't really thought through this. I don't know the last time a team had two such advanced teenage hitters like Bichette and Vladimir Guerrero Jr. It would have been like if the Expos had Andrew Jones and Vladimir Guerrero in their system at the same time instead of them being on different teams.
A couple of teams, we've got a few minutes left here. A couple of other teams I wanted to ask you about. The Chicago White Sox and the New York Yankees. Now, you have the White Sox have two players in the top 10, Michael Kopech and Eloy Jimenez. But you know, I found this interesting because I was at the winter meetings 2 years ago when Rick Hahn held that news conference where he really, a masterful news conference, I thought, by any general manager, where he really laid bare what the Chicago White Sox were going to be about. And lo and behold, this year at the winter meetings, rumors start surfacing that the White Sox may be players for Manny Machado. And I'll tell you where I'm going with this. Have they done such a good job of replenishing their minor league system, Jim, that the White Sox are now positioned something like the Phillies to be big players in next year's free agent class and maybe kind of move their ETA up a bit?
Yeah, I think they could. And I think Rick has done a really nice job. The one trade he'd like to get back is Fernando Tatis Jr. for James Shields. But other than that, he's done a great job. And I think his approach, while it's maybe this is oversimplifying it, but he did what, Derek Jeter and company maybe should have taken some lessons from Rick Hahn and company. But, when they were trading Chris Sale or Adam Eaton or Jose Quintana or these guys who had very, friendly contracts and were talented, it wasn't like he didn't come out and tell everybody, hey, we've got to get rid of these guys. We're not going to win. We're slashing payroll. It was, if you want Chris Sale, make us an offer that'll make us give up Chris Sale. And if I don't get it, I'm not going to give the guy up. As opposed to, hey, we got to get rid of these guys. And hey, we know better than anybody else. We've gotten great players, even though nobody else thinks that we have. I think a lot of times when you have these teams that have really good farm systems, two recent examples, the Cubs and the Astros, is a lot of times they're better quicker than you expect. Like, things come together a little sooner than you think. A lot of times they'll take a step back the year after that, like the Astros did in 2016, and then really be good for a while. And I do think with the White Sox in particular, shoot, look at the landscape in baseball right now. There aren't a lot of teams necessarily going all in to compete. If the White Sox young pitching came through, I wouldn't put them in the playoffs this year, but it's not out of the realm of possibility that they can even kind of like make a surprise run and be pretty respectable and maybe contend for a wild card in September this year. So I think they're very smartly, the Machado trade, that potential was interesting. It only really made sense if you were then going to sign him to a long-term deal rather than lose him. Sure. And I don't know if they're going to necessarily pay those kind of prices. It doesn't really – Jerry Reinsdorf hasn't done that since he signed Albert Bell, 20-something years ago. But I do think that they – I think the White Sox have run really well, and I think they're looking at it, like I just said, that they might be better a little sooner than people expect, and they're going to position themselves. If they can make the right trade to get an established player, a good young player, I think they'll do it. I don't think they're afraid of – the thing to remember with all these prospects, it's fun talking about them, but they don't all hit their ceilings.
Sure.
And while the White Sox have one of the deepest farm systems, it's a lot of exciting guys, they're not all going to make it. And if you could turn two or three of those guys into a superstar and you could keep the superstar, then that probably makes sense too.
Who do you see coming out of the Yankee system that might be able to help this year or next year? Is there anybody coming out of the system who could help this year? I'm thinking of a guy like Chance Adams or somebody like that.
Torres, too.
Yeah.
Torres,
They have a few. It depends on how many rookies they want to give the opportunity to, but I think you could argue right now that their best option at second or third base would be Gleyber Torres, who's one of the best hitting prospects in baseball and is capable of playing all over the infield and might have been up last year if he hadn't gotten hurt his non-throwing elbow. And if he's at second base, you could argue that Miguel Andujar is their best third base option. So I think there's two guys right there who could be in their everyday lineup if they're given the opportunity. Chance Adams is interesting because he's good. He's good, but he's one of those guys that I think looks better on paper because he's put up just crazy stats the last 2 years. But he's more of a two-pitch guy than really a three-pitch guy, and you get some guys who aren't convicted that he's as good as his numbers. But, I think there isn't much left for him to prove in the minors. He could be a back-of-the-rotation option this year, and more than that in the long run, or maybe a middle reliever if they needed that. Justice Sheffield looked very good in the Arizona Fall League. He's a guy who potentially could be in their rotation. I think he's got more upside than Adams. And a sleeper, they had one of the best relievers in the Arizona Fall League, and a kid named Cody Carroll, who was a 22nd-round pick in 2015. And he's crazy. He's 96, 98, can hit 100 miles an hour, and he's got a hard slider. And if he throws enough strikes, there could be another, it seems like the Yankees have about 15 guys who can throw 97 miles an hour coming out of their pen, and he'd be the next one. So they, as many guys as they've promoted and traded in the last year or two, they've got more coming.
I want to try to sneak in one quick philosophical question before the end of the segment. You look at the studies that have been done on age curves lately. Jeff Zimmerman of Fangraphs did one. It showed that guys are peaking at like 24, 25 now. The perception back in the Bill James days was, it's early 30s. And then he studied it. It was 27. And now we're at 24, 25. Part of that has to do with the tail of careers that we don't have the PED boost. Guys aren't necessarily excelling that late into their careers. But it seems, at least from the outside, that guys are coming in and excelling more quickly, that you can have players like Trout and Harper who just do well really well right away. The Judge can be an MVP caliber player, granted he was older, as a rookie. What might be going, first of all, am I right on this, that guys are coming in and succeeding quicker? And if that's the case, What's going on? Is it just more high-level ball, perfect game, things like that to prepare them to be good right away? Is it guys specializing more in baseball, not playing more multi-sports so they come in as finished products? What is it that makes it so the 20 and 21-year-olds seem from the outside to be able to succeed rather quickly?
I think it's all that. I mean, I've been doing this stuff, covering this stuff for 30 years. When I started, I mean, there were the area code games, and there might have been like a Team One showcase.
Yeah.
But there wasn't like you have now where you have a constant summer showcase circuit and then the Worldwood Bat Championships in the fall for high school players. There were college summer leagues at the time, but the vast majority of them outside the Cape Cod League used aluminum bats. Now everybody uses wood bats, and there's more summer leagues, and there's better summer leagues. I think the quality of college baseball, when I started, there were maybe 15 or 20 programs that pretty much were going to be the, you know, at least 7 of the 8 teams in Omaha almost every year. Now there's a lot better competition. I think players, like you said, are less specialized. There's more, you know, there's some downsides to it, too, with all the pitching injuries, but there's more year-round baseball. Even here in Chicago, where I live, I mean, we're not playing outside, but there's any number of indoor training facilities where you can learn from ex-big leaguers, you know, work on your hitting, pitch off an indoor mound, that type of thing. So I just think, you know, the old, you know, 10,000-hour theory, I just think their guys get more reps and they're more able to step in. And I also think the fact that we've seen more young players succeed, and I think not that anybody's got it down to where you know exactly what they're going to do, but I do think teams feel like they have a better handle on translating minor league statistics at the upper levels into expected performance, and now there's all kind of breakdowns as, you know, spin rate, to, you know, there's so much data that I think teams are more comfortable or at least feel like they have a better idea of exactly how much these guys are ready to contribute. So I think it's a number of factors. But I do agree with you. It does seem like, I know Anthony Kasterman's just had a story on our website. If you look at the percentage of wins above replacement compiled by rookies in this decade, it's been almost twice as much as it was the previous decade.
That's huge.
Mr. Callis, we're going to let you run. As always, it's great of you to join us.
Yeah, no, it was fun. I think you guys, I don't know who's more excited about Vlad Jr., me or Jonah, but it's
me.
Buzz.
I'm more excited than Ross Atkins. I'm more excited than anybody. Give me all the Vlad Jr. right now, opening day. Now.
Well, I will say this. I wouldn't put him on the opening day roster, but if you told, like, let's say the Jays are in contention and they need a bat.
Oh, yes.
If you told me in July, like, that Vlad Jr. was up in the big leagues and producing, I wouldn't be shocked.
Miggy Cabrera, 2003 Marlins. It's the exact comp. Jays are going to the World Series. Vlad Jr. is going to lead the way. This is what's happening.
There you go.
I'll let you guys go and dream. Take care.
Take care, guys. Bye-bye.